Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
On the production line in American packing houses, there is one cardinal rule: the chain never slows. During times of high demand, companies push their limits to get as much output as possible. According to our next guest, the risks of operating at such an unbridled rate are devastating, often leading to severe injuries and improperly processed food. Journalist Ted Genoese writes about this in his new book, The Chain: Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. The book is published by Harper, and we welcome Ted Genoese to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.
What brought you to the subject?
Well, what brought me to it originally, I suppose, was that my grandfather was a meat packer. He worked in a Swift packing plant near the Union Stockyards in Omaha during the Depression. And it was really his goal to be able to make enough money to make sure that his son, my father, would never have to do work like that again. So I've always had an interest in the plight of meat packers and the work that they do, and an interest in seeing what could possibly be done to improve their conditions.
As I was reading the introduction, it dawned on me, and then in reading the book, certainly you make this point, but speed has a lot to do with this, doesn't it?
Speed is the central issue. Really, any operation within a packing plant is safe at a slow speed, and any operation can be made unsafe at too high of a speed. But when you think about the operations that are most repetitive, the operations that are most strenuous, and certainly those that involve the use of sharp knives, the faster that those go, the more the workers are at risk.
The story that you tell in the book is primarily the story of Hormel. How did you come to them specifically, and the follow-up to that being, how typical are they in the meatpacking business?
Those questions are linked. I was interested in Hormel because of a pilot program that the USDA instituted in 2002. That program essentially wanted to look at the possibility of reducing the amount of meat inspection that occurs on the meatpacking lines in order to streamline and speed up production. Hormel was interested in this program and promoted this program, and when five plants were chosen nationwide to participate in the program, Hormel managed to get all three of its main cut and kill operations into that select group of five. So Hormel becomes the perfect case study for seeing what would happen up and down the supply chain when the speed of production was increased in the meatpacking plants.
Ultimately, then, who makes up their workforce? You write about this in at great length, and it's fascinating to see the changes that they've undergone and sustaining strikes and what they are now left with.
Yeah, well, a generation ago, these plants, as they were positioned in rural areas close to farming operations, were predictably primarily staffed by white men who had grown up near the packing plants. But when there was a major meat packing strike that occurred in 1985 and 86 at the Austin, Minnesota plant, all of that changed. After the strike, the company really moved in the direction of hiring not only Hispanic workers, but large numbers of undocumented Hispanic workers, really on the idea that this was a workforce that would complain less, that would report injuries less, and would be unlikely to unionize, much less strike. And what you ended up with in the last couple of decades was not just at Hormel, but in meatpacking plants in general, these largely Hispanic and undocumented workforces.
And interestingly, longtime workers who'd been working with the company for decades turned against the immigrant workers instead of the company in most cases.
That's right, and I think that's one of the things that's hardest to accept about sort of how everything happened there. It would have been, I guess, certainly my sentimental hope that the workers would have sort of found a way to come together. Instead, what happened, especially in places like Austin, where there was an agreement that was reached after the strike, that workers who had lost their employment due to the strike would be given preferential rehiring. But when the company in Austin created then a sort of paper subsidiary and said, this new company, Quality Pork Processors, doesn't have a contract with the union, we don't have to honor that rehiring agreement, the workers, instead of expressing their outrage toward Hormel, turned on the new workers who were brought in, viewing them as an all-scab workforce.
So how does it look now when you look at what you refer to as the chain? Who's making up that workforce now?
Well, the workforce in all of these places is dynamic, and the Hispanic workforce has been reduced some since 2009 and 2010, when Immigration and Customs Enforcement started doing what they called desktop raids of some of these plants, where they were essentially running checks of employment rolls against the Social Security rolls and looking for places where they got what they called no matches, where the name does not match the Social Security number, and telling companies that they needed to get those people off their work rolls. So what's ended up happening is a reduced number of Hispanic workers and especially undocumented workers, but many of those workers have been replaced by political refugees from other countries. In the case of Hormel, in particular, some of their affiliates and subsidiaries have been hiring Karen workers from Burma.
You write in the book that when we talk about the chain, you're talking about a chain conveyor system. But you write in the book that workers often talk about the chain as if it's a thing. It's a living, breathing thing that in many cases is feared.
That's right. If you think about it, the chain is what determines everything about how the day is going to go. And even a small increase in speed, just increasing the number of hogs that you have to process each hour by, say, 5 or 10 hogs, means that the line will be running that much faster. And what that means is that you not only have to work faster, but you have to work more precisely. You have to maintain greater concentration. And the people around you have to be doing the same. It's not just your own work, but the work of everyone on the line that is sped up. And the possibility for errors just increases exponentially. And so when increases are announced, all the workers told me that there was always a sense of tension and anxiety that would just ripple through the entire workforce.
The thing I found so surprising, and I don't say this as a joke, although it comes off glib, which is I couldn't believe that there was an increased demand for spam.
Well, spam has always been most popular during times of economic hardship. Spam was created during the Great Depression. It was most consumed during World War II, and then again during economic downturns that followed. So it's not so surprising that during the Great Recession that we've ostensibly just come through, that as the housing market was crumbling, as the stock market crashed, and as the economy slowed, the people who were looking for ways to trim their household budgets started with their grocery bill and looking for cheaper ways to put meat on their dinner table. And spam has always seen huge increases in sales during such periods, and the most recent recession was no exception.
And in some cases, it went up like 50%. They were doing 900 hogs per hour, and then by 2007 it was almost 1400.
That's right. And that's not just meeting domestic demand, but as domestic demand started tapering off as the recession eased, there was also a period of opening into international markets, and Hormel in particular has seen a huge boom in its sales in Asian markets and has been continuing to ramp up production to meet that demand, even as the American demand has reduced somewhat.
Okay, so here's the part of the interview where we get gross. So as a result of this, people are losing fingers and the arms are being crushed in the machines, not to mention that through the processing of the hogs that there is fecal matter that is processed, tumors on the animals that are processed. And when the USDA looks at this, they say, okay, Hormel, you're one of the 10 worst food safety violators in the country. But what is the overall effect of that?
Well, that's the real issue as far as I'm concerned, is that there's no real effect from that. There's no consequence of being, you know, the quality pork processing plant, the main supplier of Hormel's pork in 2012, the most recent numbers that we have available, was the worst food safety violator in the country. You would think that that would result in work stoppages, it would result in fines and other sorts of consequences, and it just hasn't. What that means is that there's no consequence for the packers and that there's no change of their behavior. And it was the Office of Inspector General's own report, its own investigation into the way that the USDA was managing this pilot program that Hormel was part of, that said, because there are no consequences, there's no incentive for any of these companies to change their slaughter operations, and we don't expect that they will.
And in many cases, the government is arguing that because of the results of the program are encouraging, that we should expand it from the 5 plants to some 600 plants throughout the country.
And that's the thing that's most shocking of all. The USDA, of course, is only looking at the impact on food safety. They're only looking at what this pilot program has done to non-compliance reports within those plants. But what they found was that 3 of the 5 plants that they allowed to run in this way, within a matter of years, wound up in the group of the 10 worst violators in the country. You would think that the result of that would be that the USDA would say this was a total failure. In fact, they've said that we think that this is enough within the range of what we would expect in the norms that we're going to proceed with the process for presenting the possibility of expanding this to all plants nationwide. And when you take a look at a company like Hormel and say, well, what are the additional effects, the rates of injury among workers, the illness among workers, the way that animals are treated on the farms, the way that the increased production has an impact on environmental safety, the consequences are really quite grave. And yet the government is saying we're going to expand this program 100-fold.
So it's impossible to read this book, at least it was for me, and not recall in high school reading Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And it's also impossible for me to not think, as I assume most readers would come away with, that in that 100 years we haven't accomplished a heck of a lot.
In some ways that's true, but what I think is most troubling is that there was definitely an improvement in food safety and a kind of coincidental improvement for worker safety for many, many years after The Jungle. The government regulation was strong and was well enforced, and things got better. Unfortunately, while things may be much better on food safety now than they were 100 years ago, I'm not convinced that food safety and certainly the conditions for workers in plants and on the farm are better than they were a generation ago, 30 years ago. I think that in the last few decades, we've really been going in the wrong direction.
It's a fascinating topic. The name of the book is The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. It is published by Harper. Ted Genoways, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Chain by Ted Genoways. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.